Morning, everyone. Meeting will come to order. We don't quite have a quorum yet, but we've got a big agenda today, and so I wanted to get started. We have two items on the agenda, and, I think the next meeting we're going to be doing the review of the governor's budget. So that's what's going to be on the agenda for a week from today. And then we'll probably start to get to the point where we're spending more time talking about bills and not doing so much overview type of things. But I guess I like to use these early meetings to talk about some of the bigger issues I think that we face financially as a state. And there's two of them that I wanted to bring up today. One is special education, which is a large program that I know all people are aware of. But it has been growing rapidly in recent years, and there's a ever bigger cross-subsidy involved in it, too, that's going to be talked about. So I thought people ought to have some background on that. And secondly, we have some very large outstanding potential liabilities for wastewater and other infrastructure that are affected by some of the different rules that we write in the state. And I think that issue in terms of how large that sort of unfunded, at least at the moment, unfunded liability is a big issue for us that crosses jurisdictional lines. It's, the public facilities authorities and the jobs committee, but there's a lot of bonding involved. The environment committee is involved. And so I think that an issue like that is also something that we should spend some time looking at as a committee. So with that, I'm going to open up with the discussion on special ed, if the people that are testifying on that can take their places in front. But I do see that there is a quorum, so I'll officially call the meeting to order. And we have the minutes of March 12th in front of us. Representative Carlson moves approval of the minutes. Are there any corrections, additions, or changes to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of approving the minutes, say aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. With that, we will go into the special education overview, and I don't know which of you gentlemen up front want to start first.
Mr. Chairman, I'll start. My name is Tom Melcher. I'm the Director of Finance at the Department of Education. With me is Paul Farron. He's our special education funding supervisor. He'll be available to answer any more detailed questions that you have.
Okay, and I see you have Tim Strom up there, too.
Yes.
Okay, welcome to the committee, gentlemen. Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman and members, you have a PowerPoint in your packet. The first slide on the PowerPoint, if we can, just is special education is an expenditure-driven funding formula. Also, the number of students involved in special education is a big influence on the cost, and there are also some elements in the special education funding formula that are tied to the number of students. So this first slide is showing you what the trend line is in terms of the number of students with a disability, birth through 21, as a percentage of the total number of students in our system. What you can see is that since 2003, we've seen an increase from about 14% of the students in Minnesota schools with a disability up to about 16.1% in the 17 fiscal year. And then we're projecting that will grow to about 17% by 2021. So in raw numbers, that's an increase from about 116,000 students with a disability up to 138,000 last year, and then we're projecting we'll be at 151,000 in the next year, by 2021.
Excuse me, Representative Carlson's got a question.
Could I ask at least one of the three to define special education, because you're referencing, Mr. Melcher, disability, and I know historically, at least if you go back, the definition of special education was broader than that, and maybe as we go through, it'd be helpful to know what we're talking about when we say special education, and then what we mean by disability and other aspects of the overall umbrella for special ed.
Mr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Carlson, I think what we're talking about here are students with a disability as defined in the federal IDEA law. Now, in the past, we've also talked about students with exceptional needs, which would be a broader category, which would include gifted and talented students as well. But here we're talking specifically about students with a disability.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, that's exactly why I raised the question, so we know exactly what we're talking about. Because when I say historically, mm-hmm. I remember our gifted and talented programs were under the umbrella of special education. Where does ELL fit in?
Mr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Carlson, that ELL is outside of what we're talking about here. There are obviously some students that have disabilities that are also ELL students, but we do not include in this a student with ELL is not automatically a student with a disability as defined in the federal.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I think it was helpful to have that clarified as to what we're referring to here.
Oh, thank you. Representative Dean, did you have a question?
No, I do not.
All right.
Representative Anderson.
Representative Anderson, all right.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Representative Carlson asked the same question that I had because I know that there are some categorization of students. It may be an issue where they're a slow test taker and so forth. So would they be under this category as well, or are you able to break it out at all?
Mr. Melcher.
Madam Chair, I'm going to let Mr. Strom jump in here.
Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson. The categories that the department is using for these estimates are based on what they call the unduplicated child count, and that's the count that fit each of the disability categories. And to get in or out of any of the categories, for example, on the autism spectrum or specific learning disabled or blind, each of those categories has entrance and exit criteria. So unless the students in that category and essentially defined as special ed because of matching that category, they wouldn't be included in this number.
All right, please proceed.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members, let's move to the second slide, which is the trend line in terms of special education expenditures per child with a disability. So we're taking the total expenditure for special education programs, including special transportation services, dividing it by the child count that I showed you on the first slide, and what you can see, and then inflation-adjusted dollars, we've grown from about a $15,000 cost for special education services up to about $17,700 in fiscal 17, and in the forecast, we're projecting that to grow to a little more than $18,000 by fiscal 21. And you can also see the unadjusted average cost per special education child. This is only the cost of the additional services that special education students receive. That's over and above the regular general education program costs. Most students that receive special education services are also receiving general education services in the regular classroom. So this chart provides a breakdown of the total cost of special education in current dollars. And what you can see here is that the funding includes transportation costs, which has grown from about $100 million up to $234 million in fiscal 17. We're projecting it to grow to about $318 million by fiscal 21. This is students that require special transportation. Not all special education students require special transportation, but these are students that would require a wheelchair lift on the bus, for example, or they require a special aid on the bus to help them with the transportation service. So in addition to that, the primary cost of special education program, it's mostly staffing teachers and other staff. So as you can see, that's the breakdown of the cost and how it has grown over the last several years. Let's move to the next slide. This next slide provides you with a breakdown of the funding for special education. The lower section in blue on the slide is the federal aid. Federal aid has been fairly constant over the years. There was a small bump that occurred around 2010, 2011 as a result of the federal stimulus package. It went away right away after a year. So the federal share has been very flat, currently around $180 million a year. And you can see the state portion has expanded significantly. And then in the red on the top, you'll see what we call the cross-subsidy, which is the unfunded portion, the part of special education costs that's not covered by by either state or federal aid that is picked up by the local school districts. And you can see that the cross-subsidy has continued to grow. It was $375 million in 2003. Fiscal 17, it was $671 million, and we're projecting it'll grow to $816 million by 2021.
Excuse me, Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And you're talking about cross-subsidy. This is also occurring in the normal transportation sparsity, normal transportation for the general population of the schools, too. Isn't that happening, too?
Mr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Detmer, yes, you can look at other areas of school district expenditures, and cross-subsidy is kind of a general term that we talk about. What's the difference between how much you're spending and what you're receiving from the state? And in the case of transportation, we've got roughly half of the school districts are receiving sufficient money through the general education funding formula to cover their transportation costs. But we do have a number of school districts that do have a cross-subsidy for transportation, for the regular transportation. And I know that this committee added some additional funding recently to cover a part of that.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And it's good to see the old crew back together again here. Mm-hmm. So the numbers we see listed on page 5 here, are these annual numbers or are these biennial numbers?
Mr. Melcher.
Mr. Chair and Representative Garofalo, these are annual numbers.
So, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Strom or Dr. Melcher, the fair to say that we should double these numbers to show what they mean on a biennial basis then?
Mr. Chair and Representative Garofalo, yes. These are the second year of each biennium is what you're seeing here.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Melcher. I was wondering if you might be able to comment on the correlation between the growth in the daily membership, which has gone from 14% to 17%. That's a little bit more than a 25% increase in special ed students. And then I'm seeing that the forecast dollar amount in millions is in total about 125% growth in dollars. So could you maybe comment on a correlation between the growth in spending and the growth in student population?
Mr. Melcher.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I would say that the growth in the student population is only one of several factors that affect the overall growth in special education costs. Just in the last 4 or 5 years, we've also seen some decreases in staffing ratios, so there are now more teachers per child, and that is probably an indication that the individual education plans of the students are requiring some additional services. We've seen, for example, staffing ratio for teachers was one teacher for every 13.4 students in 2013. It's now one teacher for every 12.8 students. We had a few years ago one paraprofessional for every 9.6. It's now one para for every 8.8. So we're seeing some increases in the number of staff per student. And, of course, we also have inflation on salaries, and salaries have been growing 1 to 2% per year over the last several years. And we also have seen some increases in fringe benefit costs as well. Health care and other costs are also part of the cost of providing these services. So the combination of more students in certain high-cost programs, and then also some increases in staffing ratios.
Representative Hertaus, did you have another question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you mentioned IEPs, and I represent a district that has 8 school districts in it, and in talking with my superintendents and some of the parents and advocates for education in the district, I got the sense from them, and I won't call out any one district, but I got the sense that the IEPs are becoming more permissive in terms of being able to have them. Are we changing the standards or the rules in which is contributing to the growing population under special ed?
Mr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, I'm not an expert on the development of the IEP process. It's something I think that needs to be looked at with the the professionals that are closer to it than I am. Mr. Barron may have a comment on that, but, again, he's more in the finance area than.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm also more on the finance side, not with the program side, or have ever actually been in a special ed program area to write an IEP.
Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Melcher, Mr. Strom, I missed the first slide, and I don't know if you covered this or not, but back to Representative Hertaus's question, the increase in the people who are, the kids who are in special education from 14 to 17%, that trend line doesn't go up or down ever. It only goes up. Do we know why we had that 25% increase over 5 years in special education students?
Mr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Druskowski, we know the categories where this is increasing. So we've seen an increase of about 8,800 students during that period of time. Most of them are in three areas. One of the areas is autism. We've seen an increase of about 2,500 students in autism. We've seen an increase of about 2,300 in developmental delay, which is the early childhood special education. Some of that may have to do with better identification of children earlier, especially as we do more early childhood programs. Students are more exposed to school, and some of those issues become more clear. The third area is other health disabilities, about 2,200 increase, and that's includes a variety of different types of students whose education is influenced by health issues.
And, Mr. Melcher, when I look at this slide, how does the total enrollment of students in the state compare now as to 2003? Is it about the same or a little more or a little less, do you know offhand?
Mr. Chairman, I believe we've been seeing some slow but steady increases in the total enrollment. So this is expressed as a percentage of the total enrollment. So the total increase in the number of students has grown from 116,000. Well, by 2021, we're projecting 151,000, so I believe that's probably a little higher than the change from 14% to 17%.
Okay, I guess I meant in terms of all students, not just special ed students.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we're seeing a slight increase in the overall student count.
Okay, so it's probably fair to say that the average cross-subsidy per student has roughly doubled for school districts since 2003. Would that be fair?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that's in the right order of magnitude, yes.
Okay. All right. Please I'm sorry. Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I only live 12 miles from Iowa, and they are number one in quality of life, so I do admit it now that I was from Iowa. And anyway, the way they figure special ed funding out is 1.5 times per student is what the non-special ed student is getting. How does that compare to us?
Mr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gunther, I believe that in our situation, we're a little bit, it's probably more closer to 2 than 1.5, would be my guess.
It'd be wonderful to find out what we do that they don't do.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just quickly, on the other health disabilities, does that also include behavioral issues?
Mr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, the other health disabilities does include, I believe, ADHD if they have certain kinds of situations.
Yeah, generally our, the special education program, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman and Representative, generally the other health disability is mostly categorized by students with ADHD as their disability. Emotional behavioral disorder has its own specific disability and its own specific counts.
Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back to slide 2 again, Dr. Melcher and Mr. Strom. So we've got those three categories, autism, development delay, other health disabilities. Has that been policy driving those increases in those three categories coming? I mean, so I think about, okay, so we're sending kids to school earlier. We're sending them at 3 years old. We're backing the school bus up to the maternity ward room doors, I like to call it. But as a percentage, that shouldn't affect this graph. Are there other policies that we have been implementing here that have been driving this incline in this graph, or are more kids getting put into those three categories at the school?
Mr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Drazkowski, I'm not aware of state policy changes, you know, other than increased early childhood education that have. There's not been a change, to my knowledge, in special education rules that would cause more students to become eligible. I think it's a question of the characteristics of the students and the decisions that are made by the IEP teams that are reviewing.
Thank you, Dr. Melcher.
Okay, Dr. Melcher, please proceed.
Okay, let's go on to the next one, Tim. So the next slide is showing the trend line in terms of the percentage of special education costs that are covered either by state or federal aid. We've been as low as 61%, as high as 73% over the last several years. There's been a very slight increase in the percentage of special education costs that are funded by state or federal aid over the last few years. And what you can see is because the federal share has been just a flat dollar amount in recent years, that's a declining percentage of the special ed cost as special ed cost grows. And the state share has been growing. You can see from fiscal 13, we were at 58.5% up to about 62% by fiscal 17, up to about 64% by fiscal year 2021. So federal share declining, state share growing, and overall we're about even in terms of the portion of special ed costs that's covered by state or federal aid. Let's go to the next slide. Okay, the next slide is showing the cross-subsidy for special education in current dollars in millions. You can see that the cross-subsidy has grown from $375 million to $816 million since 2003. There's been kind of a steady increase. It did go down around 2010 when the federal government temporarily increased federal funding. We have a dotted line on the bottom that shows what the cross-subsidy would be if the federal government fully funded the amount that was set as its goal back in the 70s, which was to cover 40% of the excess cost of special education. If that were to occur, the cross-subsidy would still be in the $200 to $300 million range. Turn the next page. The next slide is showing you how the cross-subsidy varies by district type and location. Highest cross-subsidies are in the Minneapolis and St. Paul school districts with an average of about $1,325 per student as a cross-subsidy compared to a state average of $828 per student. Suburban districts and the larger outstate districts are fairly similar in terms of their cross-subsidies in the $800 to $1,000 per pupil range. And then it's a little bit smaller cross-subsidies in the smaller rural districts. Charter schools have very little in the way of a cross-subsidy because they are allowed under state law to tuition bill the resident district for 90% of their unfunded costs. So that's shifted back to the resident district. Moving on to the next slide, Mr. Chairman and members, I wanted to do a brief comparison of the old special education funding formula that we had through 2015, and then the new formula. In the old formula, we funded based on current year data. We had different formulas for different elements of the expenditure. We funded 68% of salaries, 52% of the difference between contracted service costs and applicable general education revenue, and 47% of expenditures for supplies and equipment. Fringe benefits were not covered as part of the funding formula. That was all into the cross-subsidy. We had an excess cost aid formula on top of that, which was to try to target high-cost districts. It was designed to cover 75% of the difference between the expenditures not covered with the initial aid and 4.36% of the general ed revenue. So it would only kick in if your cross-subsidy was more than 4% of general ed funding. And the state total aid was capped in statute, resulting in proration of the aid. We were prorating in 2015. The initial aid was 88%. The excess cost aid was 67%, so you'd be getting, you know, 88% of the 68%. Moving to the new formula. The new formula was designed based on a education finance working group recommendations in 2012 that were picked up in Governor Dayton's budget recommendations. The working group recommended increasing special education funding by $150 to $200 million per year to reduce the cross-subsidy. The actual enacted increase was closer to $40 million. The recommendations were to eliminate the statewide cap on special education aid, expand the reimbursable expenditures to include all special education costs not funded with federal aid, which was primarily adding fringe benefits into the mix, calculating based on prior year data to improve predictability, to calculate part of the funding based on the number of students served by disability area and the state average cost per student by disability, with an interest in creating a more stable, predictable funding system and one that would be aligned better with our general education program, which is student-driven, and then also requiring the serving district or charter school, excluding cooperatives where students are placed, to cover 10% of the unfunded cost. Now, the way that the structure of the new...
Oh, go ahead and finish off the new formula,
okay. And
then I've got a couple people that I'm going to recognize.
So, Mr. Chairman and members, the new formula includes an initial aid and an excess cost aid. The initial aid is the sum of 100% of the special transportation cost plus the least of three different formulas. There is one formula that provides 56% of a student-driven amount, a second formula that provides 62% of the old formula cost, excluding fringe benefits, and a third formula that provides 50% of the total cost, including fringe benefits. There's also an excess cost formula where we fund the greater of 62% of the difference between the old formula cost and 2.5% of the general ed revenue, and a second formula that provides 56% of the difference between the total cost, including fringe benefits, and 7% of the general education revenue. One more slide on the mechanics of the formula. In addition to the initial aid and the excess cost aid, we have adjustments for tuition, and those are calculated using current year data. If a student is placed by the resident district in a cooperative or an intermediate district or enrolled in a charter school with more than 70% special education students, like Metro Deaf, for example, 100% of the unfunded special ed cost is billed to the resident district. We increase the aid to the serving district, and we reduce the aid to the resident district to cover that tuition bill. For other students who are open enrolled or attend a charter school with fewer than 70%, special ed students, 90% of the unfunded cost is billed back to the resident school district. These are known as tuition adjustments because historically the school districts would send tuition bills to the resident district. About 10 years ago, the state started doing those calculations on behalf of the school district. For 2017, the total tuition bills were about $210 million statewide. Oh, one last piece of the funding formula. There is a hold harmless provision which guarantees that no district will receive less aid under the new formula than it would have received in fiscal 2016 under the old formula, adjusted later years for inflation and enrollment change. We have 69 districts on the hold harmless totaling about $6 million in 2017. There is also a district-specific growth cap which limits the increase a district can get over the old formula, which is limited to $80 per student, more than the district would have received under the old formula in 2016, and then there is an increase in that amount up to $100 per student in 2017 and an additional $40 increase each year thereafter. We have 121 districts that are capped based on the aid cap. Mr. Chair and members, I do have a spreadsheet that shows you these summary calculations for each school district, if you'd like me to briefly walk through them.
That is in the members' packets. I think I'll have you not walk through it at this time. Before I recognize members for questions, I do want to tell everyone that I've decided at the end of the day today there's going to be a test on how this works. So ask your questions, Representative Garofalo.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to our nonpartisan staff up there. You know, I guess I've been around long enough to remember back in 2013, 2014, we had this roadside car fire where the DFL was in total control of state government, and they went out and jacked up taxes on everything. But I don't see that the numbers here really got better during this time. So how did all those taxes go up for education, but these numbers didn't get better during that time?
Mr. Melcher?
Mr. Chairman.
Or is that a rhetorical question, Representative Garofalo?
Oh, no, I mean, the money didn't, I presumably there's only one answer, that is the money didn't get spent on education. Is that right?
Mr. Trump.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, we'd be happy to put a chart together that shows the percent increase in both general education revenue and special ed over time.
Mr. Markworth, to that point, is that you?
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and Representative Garofalo. I think I followed you as the finance chair, so it just happens to be in 13 and 14, those years that were referenced. But remember, during that time, we did pay back, Representative Garofalo, about $600 million that was still owed to schools at the time. So on top of everything else, we had a budget deficit, but we did pay back the schools after they had been borrowed from for a long, long time. But also, now I'm not going to get in, there's a number of increases, but one of the biggest things I think happened during that time is that the gap between the kind of the largest schools and the smallest schools had exasperated up to about 33%, the difference between the bottom 5% and the top 95%. And because of that referendum we put in and that location equity index, or local option revenue now, that takes up to about 724, it actually decreased that within a couple of years from 33%, that gap, to about 20%. So it was about a 33% reduction in the difference between the 95 percentile and the 5%. And Mr. Strom or Dr. Melcher, you can, if I'm wrong, correct me on that. But it did bring up a lot of the small rural schools, because when we initially were looking at the schools that didn't have any referendums at all, there's like 40 of them still. All of them were in rural Minnesota. They didn't have any operating referendum for whatever reason. And we gave them the opportunity to bring that up to about $700. That really decreased the gap between rural schools and a lot of the other ones. So we could go into a little bit. I couldn't let that just slide, making it sound like there weren't some real good accomplishments during that time. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Well, members, I've got Representatives Drazkowski, Detmer, Pawlowski, and Fabian. And I know that Mr. Melcher has a time commitment where he has to get going. And if we reach that, we understand, Dr. Melcher, go ahead. But we've got another subject to talk about that'll take some time today, too. So let me recognize those last four. And I do want to also point out that we do have some handouts, including one from the Minnesota Administrators for Special Education that is in your packet that I encourage people to read to get more educated on this issue, too. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question, I see the, it is a complicated formula, the elimination of the statewide cap on state special education aid, and then there was another sort of cap that was put in later that I don't really understand the relationship between those two, but can you talk briefly about characterizing those two caps and the relationship between the ability for local schools to add more and more people to these categories?
Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Drazkowski, the cap that was in effect until fiscal year 2015 was a statewide cap. The cap increased annually at the rate of 4.6% adjusted for the change in state total average daily membership. So the state total special education aid would grow each year at 4.6%, plus if there was like a half a 1% increase in total student count, we'd also have that. So it might be like a 5% increase in the state total special education aid. And then what would happen is school districts would report their expenditures. Each year we would then prorate. So I think it was 88% proration on the regular special ed formula in fiscal 15. So there was kind of a statewide cap determined first. We would determine what the total aid was based on the expenditures, and then we'd prorate to spend the amount of money that we had. With the new formula, there is no statewide cap, so theoretically districts would be funded for whatever the formula calls for, except there's a cap on the amount of increase a school district can have over where they were under the old formula. The first year, that was a cap of an $80 per pupil increase over where you were with the with the old formula, and then that grows to $100, and there's some inflation in that over the years. So for an individual district's perspective, I suppose under the old formula, if you added cost, you were pretty certain you were going to get a percentage of that cost funded, but you knew you were going to be prorated. So rather than getting 68% of the salary covered, you were going to get 80% or 88% of that salary covered. Under the new formula, because it's an individual district cap, it really depends on where the district is in relation to that cap. If you're at the cap already and you add more expenditures, you don't get any increase. If you're not at the cap and you add expenditures, you're going to get roughly 60% of the costs covered by the state aid.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And back on slide 10, the last bullet point there, what really stuck out to me, that you're telling us that there's 70, that there's school districts in the state that have 70% students enrolled that require IEPs. I'm not naming any districts, but how many districts are we talking about that have 70% that have students? 70% of the students enrolled are on IEPs.
Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Detmer, we have no school districts in that situation. This is referring to charter schools. We have a few charter schools with more than 70%. I believe it's three or four. Okay. So there's Metro Deaf. They're basically only serving deaf students. We have Fraser.
There are now Sparrow, Lionsgate Academy, and Rochester Beacon Academy is now at 77%.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Pawlowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My two questions are for you. Are we anticipating a supplemental K-12 finance bill this session?
Oh, Representative Pawlowski, we are, we just got the governor's budget on Friday. I mean, I'm anticipating that there's going to be a supplemental K-12 bill and supplemental other bills that will, as has happened in the past, be rolled into one sort of supplemental finance bill that will be conferred with the Senate.
So, Mr. Chair, my second question is then, do you anticipate that there would be an adjustment in the special education formula if there is such a bill?
Representative Pawlowski, I guess I can't answer that. That would be for the an item for the committee.
Mr. Chair, I just raise it because this is Ways and Means, and the focus is usually on the larger numbers and adjustments. So if there is going to be a bill and we are going to have an adjustment, it would be a significant number.
Well, Representative Pawlowski, I would just say, I mean, I wanted to bring this forward. I'm not forward again because we see that this is a very large expenditure number for the state that is rapidly growing. There have been some changes in, of course, the way it's done in terms of the formula, and I guess I felt that this needed to be brought to people's attention. I should mention, too, that there's sort of a bipartisan effort, I think, that's going on to create a special education task force that's also been promoted by a number of the education groups to try to look further into this and look at some potential reforms that might be made in this area. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very quickly, just two things. When I'm back in the district that I represent, and I'm sure Representative Marquardt can address this too, one of the things, and I know this is not really the topic of discussion today, but the paperwork involved for staff with regards to special education is extremely cumbersome, burdensome, and they tell me it takes time away from actually spending quality time with students. As an agency, as the legislature folks, we need to address this. We need to let teachers teach and not put so much of an administrative burden on them, because the paperwork is really quite daunting, and I'm not going to get into a long discussion on that or even a short one. But I also have to go back to the conversation between Chair Garofalo and Representative Marquardt with regards to small school funding. 11 and 12, I was first term, and even though we were in the midst of a fairly significant budget deficit, we did implement the small school funding part of what we do in the formula. There were some school districts that I represented that were getting $6,000 to $8,000 less than some of the schools in the metro area per year per student, and we started to address that, and I'm thankful for that. Thank you.
Okay, I guess one last question I've got, Dr. Melcher. Then you talked about how some school districts under the new formula are at the cap, and so even if they have more special education expenditures, they don't get any additional money from the state. Can you describe the circumstances under which that happens, and do those tend to be, I mean, are those districts like Minneapolis-St. Paul, or are those regional centers, or what sort of school districts are these, and under what sort of circumstances does that happen?
Mr. Chair, members, I do have a spreadsheet that identifies the individual districts that are affected by the cap. For fiscal 18, we are not projecting that Minneapolis or St. Paul would be at the cap, but some of the regional centers are at the cap. It's just kind of a variety of school districts that are affected, and it depends on what is what's happening under the new formula. If a school district has a relatively high amount of cost for fringe benefits versus salaries, you know, the new formula includes fringe benefits. The old formula did not include fringe benefits. So if the school district's mix of salaries versus fringe benefits is relatively high, those districts tend to be at the cap. Districts that essentially didn't do so well under the old formula, that had a relatively low percentage of their costs covered, the new formula would promise them an increase, but the cap limits the amount of the increase they can get over what they were getting under the old law.
Okay, and I'll recognize the minority lead, Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I have a question. When I used to chair the Education Committee, we had a lot of discussions about the funding of the intermediates. Mm-hmm. And if one of you could review how a student is assigned or how the student receives services from the intermediate district. And for those of you from outside the metropolitan area, I'm talking about the three large metropolitan intermediates that provide online services is what the way I would put it, as opposed to some of the intermediates in greater Minnesota that have the same name but provide a different level of services. So how are they funded currently, and how is it determined whether a student receives services, I'll say in my area, 287, but there's the other two, through the intermediate versus the school district?
Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman, I'll say a few things, and then I'll ask Mr. Farron to elaborate. So the intermediate school districts, under the old formula, they did not receive direct payment of aid. They received all of the money through tuition billing of the member districts. But on the new formula, they do receive state aid, just like a school district. And so a portion of their cost is covered with the state aid. They still have a significant portion of the cost covered through the tuition billing process because the cost for those districts is relatively high. They're serving the students with the greatest needs, and so they're receiving a higher portion of their funding through tuition adjustments than a school district would receive. They're allowed to bill for 100% of their costs that are not funded through the direct special education aid formula. As far as the placement of students in the intermediate district, they have member districts, and I'll let Mr. Farron talk about what the process is in terms of the placement of students in the intermediate.
Okay, briefly, Mr. Farron.
No students' parents can open enroll into an intermediate as a district placement, or even a charter school can do a placement into an intermediate or any cooperative in the state. There are four now in the metro area, as the Southwest, or used to be Carver County, also turned into an intermediate starting in fiscal year 17. But again, as I said, all districts, they're the ones choosing the IEP team is determining that the school district doesn't have the services available to provide for the student, and they're placing into the intermediate. The intermediates are expanding more, and all co-ops in general are expanding more rapidly in the population of student and special education students than any of the districts, and therefore their costs are increasing. Due to aid being based off prior year costs, if their costs significantly increase from one year to the next, 15-20%, more of it's going through tuition billing, therefore billing back more of it to the resident districts.
Mr. Chairman, the reason I raised that question, the way I used to put it was cost sharing, because often the intermediate, at least back when I was chairing the Education Committee, was providing services to the low incidence that would have been very costly for an individual school district, but by pooling their resources among the member districts, it became more cost effective. That's why I was wondering just how those dollars were exchanged and how you determined who would get the services. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Strom.
If I could just add real quickly, Representative Carlson, you can look at the printout on the 14-inch paper, and they're sorted alphabetically there. Intermediate 287, the one representing Hennepin County, is listed there, and you can see the amount of tuition billed back, and you can see the direct payments through the regular formula to that intermediate as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, members. With that, I think we're going to have to move on to the next topic of discussion. Mr. Melcher, Mr. Strom, Mr. Farron, thank you very much for coming today.
Thank you.
And, members, again, I'd also direct your attention once more to the other materials that are in your packet that have got a printout by district and some other information as well. As we get into the next topic, members, we did provide some other information from the PCA that I believe is in your packets. We don't necessarily have them planned to be up here today, but we wanted to be able to provide that information. We'll see how it goes in terms of the discussion. With that, we're going to first recognize today some individuals from Barr Engineering who had done some studies on infrastructure costs and their relationship to rules. And then we'll move on to the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. And, gentlemen, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means. If you could state your names for the record and then give us your testimony.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Nick Nelson. I'm Vice President with Barr Engineering and one of the study principal authors. I'm also joined by my colleagues Brian Oakley and Greg Wilson. Brian was our senior engineer and the principal author on our technology and cost estimates for wastewater treatment. And Greg was the Vice President and principal author for the stormwater cost estimates and water quality improvement benefits. The legislature requested an engineering analysis and to determine a community cost related to compliance with current and future water quality regulations in 2015 in Chapter 4, Article 3, Section 135 of the Session Laws. The Office of Minnesota Management and Budget contracted with Barr Engineering to conduct this analysis. So the request from the legislature was involved three key aspects. First, the study was to be representative, a representative sample of at least 15 communities across the state. The study should estimate costs to upgrade infrastructure to meet both current and future water quality standards. And then finally, the study should estimate incremental change to water quality resulting from those upgrades. The water quality standards investigated were both current and future standards. You can see in the table on the right side, there's a designation of future for future standards. We looked at total suspended solids, chloride, nutrients, both phosphorus and nitrogen, nitrate, both as a current and future standard, sulfate as a current standard of the 10 milligrams per liter under law, applying to certain water bodies, and then the future standard on the proposed rule from MPCA that was recently not approved but would apply a different number and to more water bodies. And then finally, ammonia, both the current and future standard. This was not specifically included in the legislative request. However, ammonia is a component of nitrogen and degrades readily in natural water bodies to nitrate. The study looked at a 20-year planning time frame for both the standards and cost estimates. In this first part of the presentation, I wanted to explain how we created this study to be diverse and provide a representative number of communities. So I'll talk about the methodology of the selection of the 25 facilities and then how we narrowed that down to the 15. So there were 25 facilities identified for the study. 15 of them were primarily selected because of their availability of an MPCA evaluation for phosphorus standards. These standards are being evaluated and applied across the state, prioritized on those with the most need. The other facilities were added both from suggestions of MMB and Barr Engineering to get a better diversification in geography, size, and treatment technology types. At a high level, the following steps were used to select the facilities. You can see on the right side, the primary selection criteria was really willingness to participate by the cities. It was voluntary for their involvement in the study. So our process then looked to identify applicable current and future water quality standards for all 25 of those facilities in the study. We gathered data about those identified facilities and the water bodies for each of those 25 facilities. And then we calculated both the effluent limits for both the current and future water quality centers for all 25 facilities. For the 15 studies or facilities that made it to the cost estimate evaluation, we evaluated wastewater treatment technologies for those 15 based on the calculated effluent limits. And then we estimated the cost for performing the recommended wastewater treatment upgrades to comply with, one, the effluent limits for the current water quality standards, and then, two, a cost estimate for treatment upgrades to comply with the future effluent limits. We evaluated also stormwater infrastructure, the requirements and the estimated costs to meet the calculated effluent limits. There were six cities in this study. These were the cities of our initial 25 that had municipal sewer systems that were available, and those would be point sources that would need to comply with the rules. And then we examined the incremental downstream water quality impacts of implementing those recommended changes to the 20 wastewater and stormwater infrastructure upgrades to the 25 facilities for wastewater plants and six facilities for the municipal sewer upgrades. To provide just a little bit of perspective on how those water quality standards impact these facilities, wanted to give just a brief overview. Water quality standards do not equal permit requirements. They're a set of goals that's based on a desired use in the water quality or of the receiving streams where these plants discharge to. Those plants may discharge to impaired waters as well, and in that case, total maximum daily loads are taken into account, which sets waste load and load allocations and a margin of safety. Finally, the number of factors are put together for each specific facility requirements, including the calculation of those effluent limits, cost, timeline, and feasibility considerations. Our process looked at NPDES permits, evaluated the potential to exceed current or future standards based on the last 5 years of available data, and then we estimated future discharge limits. Of the 25 facilities, we found that 22 would have new effluent limits in either the current or the future water quality standards applied. We used a case study approach for this analysis. This figure here on this slide shows all 25 cities that were part of the study. You can see those with squares had stormwater and wastewater cost analysis along with the effluent limits that were calculated and then water quality effects. The circles show the wastewater cost analysis from the effluent limits and water quality effects with no stormwater, and then the triangles were facilities where we calculated effluent limits and the water potential water quality effects. You can see we think we had a pretty good representation across the state and the different regions and how they would apply. Now I'll turn this over to my colleague Brian, who will discuss the technology upgrades and cost estimates to meet the estimated effluent limits.
Mr. Oakley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the objective of the study was to evaluate the infrastructure cost at some specific wastewater treatment facilities throughout the state. Nick has talked about how we arrived at the 15 that we did the detailed analyses for. Of those 15 communities, there were a variety of upgrades required to meet new limits that they would get either from the current wastewater quality standards that currently didn't have permit requirements or from the proposed future wastewater quality or water quality standards that would result in new permit limits. One of the things that impacts the cost of the potential upgrades is the type of system that the SIT community currently has to treat the wastewater. We had a number of communities that had existing pond systems. Pond systems are suitable for treating total suspended solids. They can remove some phosphorus and some ammonia, but generally don't meet the low limits that are required at most communities in the state. Secondary treatment is a broad category of wastewater treatment. Some people will refer to it as mechanical treatment or activated sludge. That is suitable for meeting low total suspended solids limits. It can be modified to meet low phosphorus, ammonia, and nitrate limits. A type of wastewater treatment that we do not currently have in the state is membrane filtration. And the reason that we looked at this and wanted to introduce this is that there are two wastewater standards that potentially would require membrane filtration. Chloride and sulfate cannot be removed by pond systems or secondary treatment and would require an advanced method of wastewater treatment in order to meet those. So evaluating those at the 15 specific communities that we looked at, you can look at the figure that we have on the screen now. And what this shows is the increase in cost per equivalent residential unit. And you can think of an ERU as a typical single-family home. We evaluated communities for the number of single-family homes that they had connected to their system, as well as an equivalent number of homes to represent the industry and commercial businesses in there. So it's a way of normalizing the cost, which can vary depending on who the contributors to the system are. You can see that the costs to operate the system, to build and operate the system, increase as the complexity of the system increases. To meet current water quality standards, which would include chloride, phosphorus, and ammonia, the pond systems would require some upgrades. Those are communities that did not end up with a chloride standard. Secondary treatment would require some upgrades. These were typically pond systems that could not meet a phosphorus or ammonia limit and required activated sludge or another form of mechanical treatment to go in. And then the membrane treatment were the five communities that would end up with a chloride limit. For the proposed water quality standards, the balance shifted even further to the right, and there were seven communities that would end up with either a chloride or a sulfate standard. You can see that there is a very wide range of costs there, and the reason for that is that the communities start off with different solutions. They are located in different parts of the state. They have different flows in the receiving waters, and all of those things have a large impact on the cost for upgrading the facility. Another way of normalizing the costs is because a community that has a very high median household income obviously could potentially afford to spend more for wastewater treatment. And I believe there's representatives from the PFA who will be speaking here shortly, so I won't spend a lot of time on this. But we did evaluate the cost in terms of percentage of median household income, the cost of wastewater treatment on an annual basis divided by the median household income. And the generally accepted affordability index is 1.4%. Above that, communities can qualify for grants to reduce their costs. These are the communities at the current rates that they pay compared with the affordability index, and you can see that in general they are around that 1.4%. A few are a little bit above, most are a little bit below. With the upgrades to meet current water quality standards, most of the communities would jump above that 1.4%. And another factor that is considered is the requirement to demonstrate that a variance would be allowed. In other words, if our water quality standards say that a certain wastewater effluent should be required, at what point does cost become an issue? And one of the criteria that the PCA uses is 2% of median household income. So you can see that a number of these communities would be well above that if all of these water quality standards were enforced in their discharge permits.
And so, Mr. Oakley, let me just jump in here quick. I do want to just not take questions and go through the whole presentation, but I think it's important to understand when you determine these percentages of 2%, 3%, 4% on the cost of the system. Is that based on the community paying for the entire cost of the system, or is that based on them getting some state aid through, like, the Public Facilities Authority, as happens around here?
It's based on the community paying the entire cost with low-interest loans or bonds. So we assumed a 3% rate, which I think is actually slightly on the high side of what the low-interest loans available from the PFA are. It did not assume that any grants would be available to defer the cost, and I think that's one of the main considerations here.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to clarify that.
So again, looking at the future water quality standards, you can see that the chart has a similar shape to the previous one. Again, more stringent ammonia standards, a sulfate standard that would be enforced, and the majority of the communities end up well above the 2% line for the variance. You should also note that the City of Rochester did review our cost estimates, and they felt like our cost estimates for the city were on the low side. We did have other people review the cost estimates, and they felt that they were on the high side, so maybe we're pretty close. So the net result is that the anticipated sewer rates in the communities would increase dramatically. They would, many of them would be well above affordable rates. As currently surveyed in the communities, 8 of the 15 are below the affordability index. 7 are at or slightly above. With the current standards, we would drop to only 4 of 15, and with the future standards, only 3 of the 15 would be within the affordability range. And at this point, I'll turn it over to Greg.
Thank you, Brian. My part of the project here was to estimate the cost to comply with stormwater requirements and then estimate the incremental water quality changes resulting from both stormwater and wastewater upgrades in the future. This slide shows our stormwater costs at about $15 million annualized for the, combined for the six communities that we looked at that have are subject to stormwater permit requirements. What it also shows is that we'd be making very significant reductions in terms of total suspended solids, that are amounts of total suspended solids that are discharged to the surface waters, about 85%, about a 50% reduction in total phosphorus, and about a 30% reduction in total nitrogen. And what's contrasting the stormwater requirements to the wastewater, wastewater becomes more important under lower flow conditions if our streams and our lakes are experiencing drier weather. The wastewater will have a bigger influence on the resulting water quality, whereas the stormwater becomes more important for treatment to address higher flow conditions and higher amounts of stormwater runoff. This chart here shows how wastewater, the discharge from wastewater effluent would change the receiving water right at the outfall for any one of the cities that are shown here. And we've got ammonia on the left-hand side, about a 40 to 60% reduction in ammonia would be expected right at the outfall with current and future changes for those wastewater facilities that are shown there. Phosphorus, a much wider range. Medalia being sort of a limit decrease over what they currently have, whereas some of the other larger cities like Austin and Rochester would experience much more significant water quality changes at the outfall with these upgrades that, that Brian was describing. And then chloride is kind of a wider range, and it really is site-specific, as much as a 60% reduction at the outfall, but could be much lower depending on which facility you're talking about. As we start to look at future water quality standards, bringing in nitrate in the second column here, Austin would have a little more than a 90% reduction in nitrate, whereas Wendell on the lower end is about 30%. And then sulfate, just a few communities that would be subject to this standard, but very significant wide-ranging changes in water quality at the outfalls for those. As we start to step out and in scale and look at the entire state, we have three major drainage areas that go in three different directions, Lake Winnipeg, Lake Superior, and Mississippi River Basin. What we've shown with this chart, this is in the report, shows how much our total phosphorus reductions would, where those reductions would happen, which basin, for either wastewater or stormwater improvements, and the amounts of those are shown in metric tons. Total nitrogen, very significant reductions in the Mississippi River Basin, more due to wastewater improvements, whereas the phosphorus has a larger reduction due to stormwater improvements. And then total suspended solids is largely a stormwater pollutant that would be addressed with this, with these upgrades. This chart here shows, again, the equivalent residential unit that Brian described refers to the lighter blue wastewater facilities for the six cities that are subject to both stormwater and wastewater upgrades in the future. And so that range on an equivalent residential basis is anywhere from $200 to a little over $800 per ERU. On the right-hand bar for each one of the respective cities shows stormwater normalized to cost per impervious acre, generally in the range of $800 to $1,000 per impervious acreage for each community. Are there any questions?
Okay, I'm going to take a couple questions, but then I want to go on to the other testifiers here, because I do believe we've got some local officials that want to testify. But I do have Representative Agenius and Liebling. I think I'll the chair of the Capital Investment Committee, Representative Erdahl, I'll take those questions. Representative Agenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have questions in two different directions. But the first is, the chair and I have something in common. That our communities drink Mississippi River water, and Representative Hausman's the same. So in the upper Mississippi, above our drinking water intakes, there are 203 wastewater treatment systems. So did you look? I didn't see it in here, but can I assume you looked at the cost to us to clean up the Mississippi for drinking water purposes, if and how that balances out with the cost of having upgraded wastewater treatment systems?
Mr. Oakley, you want to take that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the discharge standards are intended to protect the river for drinking water. And so we didn't look specifically at what needed to be done to accomplish that. The assumption on our part is that those standards are needed to protect the drinking water. And so we're looking at the cost for meeting those standards at the wastewater plants.
If Mr. Chair, if I could follow up.
Yeah, Representative
Guinness. Some folks will use this as an argument not to have standards. And that will be the argument I'm afraid we're going to hear. But when we discussed this in the Environment Committee, what the PCA said was that most of the cost of infrastructure redevelopment and wastewater was actually because of old pipes, et cetera, and that only 7 or 5, and I don't know which is the right number, but that small percentage was because of new standards. So what we were discussing is, in the long run, it would be less expensive for us to set aside some money for my community to help pay for wastewater treatment systems to the north of us, rather than to spend money to upgrade our drinking water system if those standards were not met by a wastewater treatment system. So if our analysis doesn't go further and look at that balance, I don't think we're we don't have enough information on the table to make good decisions.
Mr. Oakley?
Mr. Chair, Representative, you bring up a good point about the cost, and our study was scoped to evaluate the costs for increases due to changes in water quality standards. The point you make about existing facilities and the costs to maintain the service that's already there wasn't part of our scope, but you are correct. That is a very large number, and I believe the PFA and the PCA have a lot of information about those costs.
If I can, Representative Lukinas, maybe I can come back to you later, but I want to keep on schedule here, and you've had two questions. So anyway, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This should be pretty quick. And as I'm looking at the materials, I realize it may be probably you didn't make the decision anyway, maybe asking the wrong person. But the affordability index and the choice of using a percentage of median household income, and I see here that that was that's something that's probably a decision made by the Minnesota Public Facilities Authority to have that as the index. But maybe it's just a comment that I wonder if that makes a lot of sense, because the municipalities can't tap. They don't get to tax by income. They get to tax by property tax. And so I don't know. I'd be curious, you know, if we to know, probably not right now, whether how close those two measures would be, you know, and because I represent Rochester, naturally I'm thinking about this, seeing, well, Rochester can afford it, you know, because our median income might be higher than some other communities, but our property tax availability might not actually be as high as the median income, and of course the city can't get a percentage of median income. They don't get to do an income tax. So just wanted to lay that out there, Mr. Chair.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Oakley. As chair of the Capital Investment Committee, we certainly plan on, I would hope, making a significant investment in our infrastructure, in our wastewater, in our clean water. My question is, when rules and regulations are imposed upon communities, how are those decisions made, and what impact do you have? I know the MPCA will make pronouncements. I'm sure that some other examples will be coming up, but with other testifiers, I just want to cite one. You know, the city of Avon, and these are, I've become aware of a lot of these types of situations where they were told that they had to do a new wastewater treatment plant. It was a 20-year projection, and they were supposed to have a 4,400 population after 20 years. It's gone up 400 to 1,500 people, and so we now have a city that had a huge struggle to pay for this. Thankfully, the PFA and some others stepped up to help, but the projections haven't come out. They now have a plant that can accommodate more than twice the amount of people that are in the city. Because their median income was a little high, they couldn't qualify for aid at first. And so these burdens are being placed on cities all across the state, and I'm wondering how these decisions are made.
Mr. Oakley, Mr. Nelson.
So I'll just briefly state kind of the process for permit limits. I mean, the permits, as they're renewed every 5 years, so that would be the point where a new water quality standard or a change water quality standard would be incorporated into a permit limit. Those rulemakings are also public, so there's an opportunity for cities to comment on public rulemaking and how those might impact the city. But generally, they're incorporated during that that permit-making process. There is a bit of a negotiation, but it is driven based on the receiving stream they're in, total flow, and their projected population increase, among other factors. But there is some consideration for cost of the upgrades and the timing to implement as well. I think one of the challenges you're bringing up is the timeline for a new investment around additional changes or future water quality standards and having predictability on that.
Representative Erdahl.
One brief follow-up. Thank you. And, I appreciate the difficulties in making projections of this type, but, I mean, we have a city forced to do a project more than they could afford and twice what they need.
Mr. Nelson, Mr. Oakley, Mr. Wilson, thank you for your testimony. If you can hang around for another half hour till the end of the committee, that'd be great in case we do get back to you with other questions. But at this point, I'd like to have representatives from the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities come forward and give us their testimony. Mr. Flaherty, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means, and if you could introduce yourself for the record and the other gentlemen and give us your testimony.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm Tim Flaherty, representing the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, and we've got several testifiers today. The first one is Mayor Tom Kuntz to my left, and he's going to open us up.
Mr. Kuntz, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thanks for taking time to hear our testimony on a very subject for important to Greater Minnesota Cities. My name is Tom Kuntz. I'm the mayor of Owatonna. I'm also a member of the board of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, or CGMC is the abbreviation. I'm here representing 95 members of the coalition. First, I want to thank the chair and members of the committee for taking time to hear our perspective on water quality regulations and their huge cost on our residents and businesses. The coalition believes the state and the coalition need to take steps together to better control costs and improve water quality throughout Greater Minnesota Cities. The coalition has worked on science, cost, and benefits of water quality regulations going back to 1994. In 1997, the coalition asked water quality professionals in their cities to form a separate joint powers board under Minnesota statutes to review water quality regulations and permits so that they could advise the coalition about the cost and benefits of regulations. The Joint Powers Board of Wastewater Professionals was formed in 1997 and is named the Minnesota Environmental Science and Economic Review Board, which we refer to as MERSER. I mention this because MERSER has offered to help you meet your responsibility to oversee Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. The coalition would like you to hear from Tim Flaherty from Flaherty and Hood about the bar study, Greg Kirkman from Little Falls about the cost and impact of new regulations on their cities, Kyle Skoll from Public Work Director from Owatonna about mistakes that can happen in the permitting process, and Dan Marks from Flaherty and Hood about the cost drivers that lead to excessive regulations and costs. Then I would like to have Tim Flaherty make a few concluding remarks. We're asking for your help in controlling unreasonable and excessive water regulation costs, which the state and local business and residents have to pay, establishing a new financial partnership with cities to keep their businesses and residents from paying excessive and sometimes devastating water rates. Again, thanks for scheduling time for this critical topic. So now I would like to turn it over to Tim Flaherty to talk about the bar report.
Mr. Flaherty.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Tom. In 2014, the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities was alarmed at the new water quality regulations on the horizon and the huge cost that it would be imposed on businesses and residents in Greater Minnesota Cities. We called it the regulatory tsunami, and it included things like the phosphorus standards for lakes and rivers, wild rice sulfate, chloride standard, mercury TMDL, anti-degradation, and nitrates. So in 2015, we asked the legislature to fund a study on the costs of municipal stormwater wastewater systems, which you just heard Barr talk about. The result was that report, and I have to tell you we have high praise for the report, and we think it was well worth the $500,000 you spent on it. It was a wake-up call, really, for our cities about these huge costs they're going to be facing, and we think it should be a wake-up call for you. Now, we would like you to have some time when you have a couple hours or appropriate committees to have a couple hours to go into that study, because it is excellent. We have a lot of questions about it. I'm sure others do. But it got the ball rolling. We want to make 3 points about the report. One, the stormwater cost estimate for cities to comply with the current and future water requirements is more than $7.9 billion over the next 25 years, or $317 million per year, which the report notes is conservative.
Second, excuse me, let me jump in and tell members that $500,000 report, you saw only a summary of it. There is, it's 494 pages altogether, and we have put it on the committee website. So go ahead, Mr. Flaherty.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Excellent point. And it is worth every penny of it from our perspective. Wastewater, the capital cost for the 15 greater Minnesota cities in the study will exceed $400 million. Nine of the 11 cities will see their annual rates jump by $500 per user. That's jumping $500. For comparison, the average annual rate in the metro is $274, according to the Met Council. Now, in your packets, we selected out two of the cities that were in the study. That was Albert Lea, where the increase is more than twice, which would jump their fees to $1,082 per year. That's $1,082 per year. Austin, the increase is more than three times, which would get up to $1,110. This is a massive increase, and our view is, and you'll hear more about this later, that your grant programs are totally inadequate to deal with these kinds of cost increases.
And I'm sorry, Mr. Flair, when you talk about $1,110, you're saying that's $1,110 per person
per year
in increased cost to comply with these requirements?
No, it's $1,000 total, so probably like, think of it as $500 now, and you're adding $500 to it.
Okay.
It's, you know, so that would be the total cost. Does not include the cost of, or that's the total cost. So arguably one or more of these cities might be able to get the $7 million capped PSIG grant. So that would reduce that, but it's not going to reduce it that much. We're going to get into some of the numbers a little bit later, but It's a massive amount, and if you, I mean, you can just think of your residents. Remember, these aren't communities that have high, you know, the median incomes in these communities are not what, this is a lot of money for the residents in these communities. The CGMC believes the wastewater costs in the report are conservative, because it does not fully address future compliance costs like anti-degradation impacts, phosphorus implementation methods, or costs of treating for mercury. Now, it's a good report. It's a very good report. And I'm sure others would say, well, it overestimated the costs. We're saying it way underestimated the costs. And we have a lot of rationale for that and documentation for that. One of the cities, which I think the bar people mentioned, had their engineer look at the estimate that bar did and concluded that the estimated cost was really $215 million, not the $107 million that bar estimated. Doesn't mean the bar report isn't good. There is a lot of variability and a lot of assumptions that go into these things. So I want to just draw your attention to a couple things, and we'll move on to the other testifiers. In your packets, there's a letter to Governor Dayton from Rochester dated July 31st, 2017. They're pointing out that the $210 million they would have to spend in capital costs and $24 million in annual operating costs, additional, would get a 2% phosphorus load reduction in Lake Sunbro and 1% reduction in the Mississippi River. And they question whether that is worth $200 million. So I'm just going to zip through this, but the information is all there. If all the cities in this watershed upgraded their facilities and they all contributed zero phosphorus to the Sunbro River, which they'd spend millions, hundreds of millions doing, the improvement would be minimal because the more than 90% of the phosphorus isn't coming from the cities. It's coming from other sources. So we're spending a lot of money to get virtually no benefit. see the letter from the 44 cities in the Minnesota River Basin, which is in your packet. That's a case where they adopted a standard, which we seriously disagree with, but then when the MPCA went to implement it, they implemented it in a way that would make it like six times more restrictive than it was intended when they passed that standard. And the cities there, I mean, it's 44 cities that signed this letter, and they basically say we cannot stand for an approach that overburdens our cities with these expensive regulations that will fail to actually improve the river or needlessly harm local economies. Last example in your packet is Osakis, a little community up a little north of Alexandria, less than 2,000. It's required to build an $11 million facility to reduce phosphorus in Lake Osakis less than 1/1,000th of a percent. Letters and information's in the packet. The BAR report demonstrates that we are in a funding crisis to pay for water treatment. The examples of Rochester, Osakis, and the Minnesota River Basin demonstrate that greater Minnesotans are subject to excessive regulations and costs, and that reform of the water quality regulatory process will save the business and the residents and the state billions of dollars over the next 20 years without hurting water quality. For a brief presentation about the costs, I have Greg Timmon from Little Falls here to talk about what happens in the city, really.
Mr. Timmon, welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Thank you for having us this morning. My name is Greg Timmon. I'm with the City of Little Falls. I am the city engineer. Little Falls is a regional center in the middle of the state. We've been operating a water and sewer service there for approximately 80 years now. With aging infrastructure and additional regulatory expectations and incomplete state funding, it's increasingly impossible for the city to meet our obligations. For example, a recent MPCA regulation would place new phosphorus limits on our wastewater treatment plant that would reduce our phosphorus contributions to the Mississippi River by 1%. That regulation requires an $11 million upgrade to our wastewater treatment facility on top of the $6 million repairs necessary because of the age of the plant. Assuming the state bonding bill passes this year with enough money so Little Falls gets a $7 million point source implementation grant to help pay for our $17 million project cost, our rates would go from $38 a month currently to $51 a month projected. That may not seem like a lot, but our household income is only $37,020 per year. And we have over $7 million in other infrastructure needs to repair. That includes streets, distribution pipes, and stormwater. For comparison, the average monthly charge for households in the Twin Cities metro area is $23 per month.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Flaherty.
For a brief presentation about the cost drivers that lead to, I'm sorry, I skipped one, for a brief presentation on mistakes that can be made in the permit process that can be extremely expensive, I'm calling on Kyle Stove, the Public Works Director of Owatonna.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Scove.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kyle Scove. Thank you for allowing me to testify today. I am the Public Works Director and City Engineer for the City of Owatonna, and I've been in this capacity for a little over 5 years. One of my responsibilities is oversight of the city's wastewater treatment facility. And the city's been a member of the Minnesota Environmental Science and Economic Review Board, or MESRB for short, and voting member since for several years. It's a joint powers organization made up of roughly 45 cities, sanitary districts, and public utility commissions in greater Minnesota. MESRB's mission is to work to ensure water quality regulations that impact municipal wastewater are technically sound and implemented in a manner that is reasonable, cost-effective, and results in meaningful benefits to water quality. One of the benefits of this membership is MESRB provides a high-level technical review of draft wastewater permits for its members. So when we receive a proposed limits from the MPCA, we can rely on MESRB to take a look at those. And they've been performing this service for over 20 years. MESRB members do not perform the permit reviews. They are managed by MESRB, and outside technical consultants do the review. MESERB currently hires a small but nationally recognized technical consulting firm, Hall & Associates, based in Washington, D.C., to provide this service, and also contracts with Flaherty and Hood to provide administrative and legal consulting services. Last year, in 2017, Owatonna received a draft wastewater permit from the MPCA and requested review to be completed. The draft permit included a permit limit for specific conductance. Specific conductance is a salty parameter or a pollutant that is very difficult to treat for and can require extremely expensive wastewater treatment or other options that are very expensive to accommodate. MESERB reviewed the permit and identified potential errors by MPCA that resulted in the specific conductance limit. The city submitted a letter responding to those proposed limits to the MPCA, and through that correspondence, the MPCA agreed to remove that permit limit. Had the city been forced to comply with the specific conductance limit, it is likely we would have had to perform some type of major upgrade to our system, which at the wastewater plant would include membrane filtration or reverse osmosis, and would have cost in excess of $50 million. MESERB's permit review service provides us a valuable service and helps cities identify technical errors and other issues that in many cases would otherwise go unaddressed. Presently, MESERB only provides these review services to members and completes about 5 to 10 permit reviews per year. The proposed legislation would provide funds to MESERB to expand this service throughout greater Minnesota. It would also provide necessary resources to perform more detailed review of the technical validity of permit requirements, the costs to comply with those requirements, and assessment of environmental impacts. MESERB believes it is essential to have a party independent of the MPCA perform this type of permit review, and that such a review provides a much-needed check and balance within current permitting framework. Because MESERB and its members have technical expertise and are ultimately responsible for implementing regulations and being good stewards of state, local resources to do so, MESERB is uniquely qualified to take on this effort, and we would be willing to partner with the state to perform this service. We believe these permit reviews would lead to significant cost savings for the state, local governments, and the residents and businesses they serve. This review would also help ensure the requirements placed in wastewater permits are technically sound and will lead to meaningful environmental benefits. If the legislature elects to partner with MESERB in this effort, MESERB would be willing to manage the program, but would likely hire a new program administrator and contract with a major national engineering firm or several engineering firms in the state. To be clear, we believe such permit reviews are necessary. However, if the legislature chooses to partner with a different government body independent of the MPCA, such as Legislative Water Commission, to perform such a service, MESERB would be fully supportive. Thank you again for allowing me to testify, and I urge you to promote this.
Thank you, Mr. Scove.
The last,
Flaherty.
Mr. Chair, the last testifier we have is Daniel Marks, who's going to talk about some of the cost drivers that lead to excessive regulations and costs, and that's Daniel Marks.
Mr. Chair, Daniel Marks, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Daniel Marks, and I'm an environmental attorney with the law firm of Flaherty and Hood, and I represent local governments and associations in greater Minnesota on environmental issues with a special focus on wastewater permitting and Clean Water Act compliance. And as Mr. Flaherty indicated, I'm going to talk briefly about some of the cost drivers related to the regulation of wastewater, share some examples similar to the ones that we've heard that illustrate some of our concerns and identify some potential solutions. When we talk about cost drivers with wastewater regulations, I think that there's kind of four main points. First, generally speaking,
with wastewater treatment, we're starting to hit a point of diminishing return. You know, over the last 30 years, as a result of the implementation of the Clean Water Act, municipal wastewater facilities in greater Minnesota have spent billions of dollars in wastewater treatment technology and as a result have made significant water quality improvements in the state. However, we're starting to reach, like I said, that point of diminishing return where when new regulations are developed and applied to wastewater treatment facilities, the cost to comply with those regulations are increasingly expensive because of additional technology, et cetera. And in many cases, certainly not all, the environmental benefits of those regulations are increasingly small and disproportionate to the costs, in large part of the result of the previous efforts that have been made. And this is one of the major cost drivers, that problem of diminishing return. Second, you know, from our perspective in evaluating MPCA regulations and the implementation thereof, we often find that MPCA regulations are over-conservative as applied to municipalities, and MPCA has, in some cases, they go further than what federal law requires and what other states in our region do with respect to regulating municipalities. And this also can be a cost driver. It's a question of value at the state level of how far and how aggressively we want to regulate, but those types of decisions obviously can become a significant cost driver. And the last two points I'm going to talk a little about in more detail, and this is really what I would characterize as kind of the failure early in both the rulemaking process and in the permit development stage to analyze and to disclose the costs and cumulative impacts of regulations and their environmental impacts. And then this kind of feeds into what we kind of say is a problem of unreasonable application of regulations, as I would, you know, argue that you've heard in some instances so far. And what we find are often agency roadblocks to the use of creative, flexible, and cost-effective approaches. And so to illustrate these last two points, I just want to give a quick example from a recent experience. Right now I'm representing the Alexandria Lake Area Sanitary District, which is up in Alexandria, Minnesota. And ALASD is being forced to look at spending $14 million in a wastewater infrastructure upgrade to comply with a water quality standard for Lake Winona. Unfortunately, this $14 million expenditure will not lead to a meaningful improvement in the lake as a result of a current invasive carp species infestation. So carp have dominated the lake, and as a result, this infrastructure upgrade really won't benefit anything. The district has raised this concern repeatedly and has worked with a top lake scientist to identify the problem and develop a targeted solution that will achieve water quality standards in Lake Winona, get rid of the carp, and then reduce pollution to some of the downstream lakes. The cost of the district solution ranges from $600,000 to $1 million, a fraction of the cost of the infrastructure upgrade. This proposed solution, spending $600,000 or maybe $1 million to solve the water quality problem versus spending $14 million, which won't solve the problem, is a no-brainer. But in order to be able to do this, it is very complicated from both a regulatory perspective and has required the district to initiate administrative litigation, pursue a variance application with the agency, and really try to push to, one, identify the solution and to push the agency to go along with it. And if ALASD is successful, you know, the ALASD is also pursuing legislation this session to facilitate this creative permitting approach, and the PCA is working with us, and we're working on negotiating the permit language and the regulatory flexibility to make this happen. And if we're successful, it will restore two lakes, save the state $7 million, which is what the district would be eligible for through the PSIG funding if we did the infrastructure upgrade, and save about $6 million for the local community. And so this example demonstrates how difficult it is sometimes in the current regulatory framework to develop cost-effective and flexible approaches. And it should not be necessary for a local government to have to, you know, potentially sue or pursue legislation to implement a cost-effective solution like this. And a lot of cities in greater Minnesota, frankly, you put the burden on them alone, they don't have the technical resources to do that, and a lot of times they don't have the stomach to push the agency in and negotiate. And this example raises kind of two questions. How could such an expensive regulation that would lead to such a limited environmental benefit be placed in a permit in the first place? And why is it difficult to implement that more cost-effective approach? And in my representation over the last few years of cities, I've seen similar examples like we just heard where the cost to comply with the regulation is tens of millions of dollars for a small city like Osakis or Little Falls, or potentially hundreds of millions for Rochester. But the projected environmental benefit of the regulation is either not carefully evaluated and presented to the community, or when it is carefully evaluated, the benefits are minuscule. And I think most of us would agree that it makes sense that prior to requiring a community and the state to spend millions of dollars to comply with the regulation, that an evaluation of the costs, the impacts on user rates, and the projected environmental impact should at least be performed and presented to the community. And where the costs significantly outweigh the benefits in that analysis, that something needs to be done to ensure that the environment is adequately protected without wasting resources. And there is nothing in current law that explicitly requires this analysis to take place prior to the implementation of a regulation into a city's permit. The default position is generally for cities to upgrade wastewater treatment facilities when there are compliance issues. And we get a lot of talk from the MPCA that they want to be flexible, they want to work with us, they'll give us compliance schedules and variances. And in some cases, that's true. But as I said, we often find that cities are really the ones that have to push for this. They have to develop it, they have to invest resources, they have to identify alternative solutions, and they have to push for that flexibility. And without some assistance from the legislature and additional oversight from the legislature, that becomes a difficult ask. And so what we need, what cities need, first and foremost, is we need this information. We need the legislature to provide more oversight over the MPCA's development and implementation of wastewater regulations and to ensure that some entity, independent of the MPCA, evaluates the agency's implementation of these regulations into wastewater permits in greater Minnesota.
Okay, Mr. Marks, just a minute. Are you just please finish up here? We're really running out of time.
I have 30 seconds. So this evaluation, you know, is the application of the regulation technically appropriate and necessary to protect the environment? What will the cost of compliance be for the city and the state, and how will those costs impact residents and businesses? And what is the projected environmental impact? It is essential that this happen prior to the time when these regulations take place or have impact in a permit so that we can address those questions of how much do we want to spend, for what benefit, what's the flexible approach here. And so I will conclude with that, but thank you for the opportunity to present.
Okay. Mr. Flair, did you have something else?
I just wanted to tell you that there are two bills kind of moving through the process, two ideas we have, and I want to thank Representative Erdahl for taking a new look at this grant program, which many people have had good questions about it, and about this affordability standard, which we have a lot of concern about. So I'm happy he's authoring that bill, and we're hoping that we can hear that. But, so I want to thank some of the members who really helped us here to bring this forward and to try to look for solutions.
Okay. Members, we're running kind of long today, and I know we're bumping up against our noon deadline here. I know I've got some members that want to ask questions. I've also got a representative from the Public Facilities Authority here that I wanted to have testify. We've got his materials here in the packet on some of the costs that we see in the future. And I think maybe I'll have Mr. Freeman come down real quickly if I can. And if members have to go, they have to go. But I think, you know, we wanted to try to get a sense of what some of the upcoming costs potentially were here. And I guess if we could just have, you know, maybe 5 minutes for Mr. Freeman, and if members, we may have to cut it off after that. If members have questions afterwards, they can maybe talk to some of the testifiers. Mr. Freeman, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And as you said, there is a handout. My name is Jeff Freeman. I'm the Executive Director of the Public Facilities Authority. The handout, and clearly, you know, I have to start by stating the obvious. My agency is the financing agency, and so the issues of standards and limits and costs and benefits are not something that I can address directly. But I would say that the handout starts with looking at need surveys, which on the wastewater side, the Pollution Control Agency every 2 years does a survey of cities in the state looking at wastewater needs overall, new standards as well as rehabbing and fixing of old pipes and old treatment plants. They just completed the most recent study. It was based on 2017 data. They put a number of $5 billion over 20 years for wastewater projects overall. As you can see, the breakdown, 5% of that was put on advanced treatment, which is the more stringent limits. The vast majority of those needs were based on fixing old pipes, rehabbing old treatment plants. You know, there's no doubt that for individual cities that have a permit today to meet a more stringent limit for phosphorus or something like that, I mean, there can be significant costs. There's no doubt about that. But overall, the real issue that we see every day with projects on our priority list or the PCA's priority list are those rehab projects. I think it's very difficult to look down the road and project what future water quality standards will be and what the effluent limits will be from those standards. We've certainly seen over the history, past decades, there have been a lot of cases where what seemed like was going to be a very expensive treatment plant upgrade to meet a standard. There were other ways. Mr. Marks just called out an example, a current example of Alexandria, which my understanding is the Pollution Control Agency actually came up with the idea of doing the lake management activities instead of the capital improvements at the treatment plant. PCA, I know, has proposed an LCCMR project to look at what's called wastewater optimization, what can be done at the treatment plant through the operation of the treatment plant to achieve better nutrient reduction than what they were otherwise able to do. So I think I take with a grain of salt these large estimates looking far into the future. What we look at is project priority lists, which right now there's a wastewater list of $1.5 billion, 300 and some projects. As we look at those projects coming forward and the pace that they're coming forward, we have in the backside of the sheet talks about our loan programs, talks about the grant programs. With the governor's recommendation to increase the grants, because there's no doubt that small communities need additional help beyond what's been done. A major part of that is the point source implementation grants that are specifically directed at meeting the more stringent limits. There's also the WIF grants that help based on affordability criteria. Those things we're seeing, there was a big bonding bill and an increase in those programs last year. We're hoping, and the governor has recommended another increase this year. We're seeing those making real differences and a lot of projects coming through. So as far as what we see in the project pipeline with the proposals from the governor, it seems like we're in pretty good balance. Individual cities, there's no doubt, are facing significant costs, but we feel like there is a good match of a good framework of low-interest loans and grants that are helping cities deal with that.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Freeman. So, members, what I'm going to do is I'm going to run us up to 12:15, and then I'm going to adjourn. I'll go to if they've got to go before then, that's fine, but I know I've got some member questions. Representative Hamilton, Garofalo, and Wagenius. Representative Hamilton.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to point out, in the little town of Dundee, there's 68 people there, and upgrade their wastewater treatment facility. It was $2.4 million. So for a family of four, that's $141,000. And if you look at the list here in the top 52, 25% are in the district that I serve or right on the fringe of that. Very, very small populations. And when you take a look at the maps as far as water quality and stuff like that, we get pointed out the southwestern part of the state. It's pointed at quite a bit as far as poor water quality down there. And then when you take a look at this list and we have 25% of the towns that I represent make up 25% of the top 50 on this list. We need substantial assistance in this area. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, well, I would be curious. You know, this is I'm not going to ask this question, but it would be interesting to know how much of a reduction in pollution we would get by doing that list, because it comes down to a question of, I mean, is it point source or non-point source that's causing the issues down in that area? But anyway... Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I just want to verify some information we were given in our packet regarding Osakis. And I'm reading here that at a cost of $11 million, there being the net benefit to this is that it would reduce phosphorus by 162 kilograms a year. And I just want to make sure that this is actually, I mean, this just sounds insane.
Did I have someone from the coalition? I think that was something that they had presented, come up and speak to the Osakis issue.
Yeah, and I don't mean to elaborate on this, but, like, I mean, that's just so even, and I know government screws some things up every once in a while, but just looking at that, I mean, $11 million for 162 kilograms, is that correct?
Mr. Flaherty.
I don't know what the conversion is. We have 1/1,000th of a percent of reduction or something, but... yes, I think that it's minuscule, the benefit. I mean, we joke around the office that, well, you move two cows out of the watershed, then you'd be a lot better off than spending $11 million and you get the same result. But so, I think that the people that put that together for us, I think, would stand by that. So, and that's the problem. I mean...
Representative Garofalo.
Okay, well, I saw the MPCA stood up. I don't know if they want to elaborate on that. I mean, that seems to me like way outside the strike zone of acceptable, and I'd kind of like to know if there's more to this story or not. I can learn about
sure. it. Sure, let's have the representative from the PCA come forward. Welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Greta Gothier, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Thank you for the opportunity to respond. So Osakis is a good example of kind of the entire bar study, which is a well-done study, and for the assumptions that they made, they did a good job. But the study assumes that every city is going to be building a brand-new plant from basically scratch and complying with all of these rules that may or may not come to play. For example, on chloride, the commissioner we are not going to apply or enforce the chloride standard of 230 milligrams per liter, which has been on the books since the 1990s. Instead, the commissioner brought a bunch of communities together, a representative group of cities, to figure out a way that we can help cities quickly find out whether or not they can get a variance on chloride, and that system is now up and running. So that is a way we've been flexible. With Osakis, we are working with them right now to do an offset. So what that means is we're helping them find a way to reduce pollution into the receiving water so that there is more capacity in the receiving water and then the city doesn't have to change their plant. We actually came up with that solution in Alexandria, and we are supporting legislation working through the legislature now to fund the alum treatment and CARP removal in Alexandria. And in Osakis, we are working to work with a local landowner to have their herd of cattle managed such that it is no longer creating an inflow of phosphorus from that herd into the lake, which is the same lake that Osakis discharges into. So if Osakis had to comply with everything and the outer limit of what they might have to do someday might be $11 million, but we're going to be able to fix that through flexibility and doing an offset with a local cattle producer.
Okay, so, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Rothwell.
Mr. Chairman, so what I'm hearing here is that it's not necessarily that it's going to cost $11 million to reduce 162 kilograms of phosphorus, which and that restores my sanity, so thank you.
Mr. Flaherty, did you want to speak to that?
Well, I would, and I think Mr. Marks has been working on that, but this mythical flexibility that the PCA has doesn't come up unless we put up strong opposition. They're a barrier, a roadblock to all this stuff. So didn't we have to file a contested case in that, in the Osakis case, or what happened?
Mr. Marks.
Mr. Chair, so in the Osakis matter specifically, and just generally speaking, I think Ms. Gauthier is correct that there are some pathways for flexibility at the PCA. But I think in the Osakis matter, but for Osakis engaging some independent consulting, the result would have been an $11 million upgrade to reduce whatever the number is in phosphorus. Osakis had to challenge their permit through a contested case process, do some significant analysis with an engineering consultant, and really push for that flexibility. And the point is not that PCA is necessarily anti-flexibility. I think that the PCA, it's hard to be flexible, but a lot of that fundamentally it's coming down on these cities. That it's not the agency saying, here's your limit and here's a flexible way to implement it. It's the agency saying, here's your limit, you figure out how to deal with it. And a lot of these cities have a hard time analyzing and taking a hard look at how do we reach this objective in a cost-effective way. And we get a lot of roadblocks from the agency within the current regulatory framework to be able to operate flexibly.
Okay. We've dragged on pretty long here, but I want to ask, I want to give Representative Oginius, who's been extremely patient, a chance to ask for her last question. So go ahead, Representative Oginius, then we'll conclude.
Okay. I'm very sympathetic to
the cost. Can you use the microphone, Representative Oginius?
I'm very sympathetic to the costs, and I've said that again and again, and we should be doing more grants. But there are two issues that are not on the table here, Mr. Chair, that I think we really need to, I mean, we're talking about silos here. We haven't talked about prevention and what that could save. I mean, we spent $500,000 on this is the cost. We haven't spent $500,000 on how we could prevent some of these costs. We haven't spent $500,000 on engineering. We have, at the University of Minnesota, civil engineers who specialize in wastewater treatment that are nation-leading. I mean, these are really good people. We should be asking them, are there things we can do to reduce the costs and without having to reduce standards? I mean, we're not asking the people that are the smartest to help us out. So it feels like we're too much in silos here to me. We need to have a broader conversation about what we can actually do.
Okay. Representative Torkelson.
Just a few seconds. So the Legislative Water Commission spent much of the interim looking at exactly these sorts of issues. We have a series of recommendations that we have issued just this last week. This is a topic that requires a lot of time and analysis to reach reasonable conclusions on, and I would hope that we can move forward in a wise fashion. You're right, Representative Wagenius, and that's one of the things we've highlighted is the need for further study of making these systems more efficient.
And I do think we have the Water Commission recommendations were included in the packet, too. Okay. Mr. Flaherty, any last words, and I'm going to conclude.
No, Mr. Chair, I want to thank you and the committee members that that were here to for their comments, and I think it is it's a huge cost problem. I think that we have to work together on it, and I appreciate Representative Lugenius pointing out that this isn't the only answer. There are ways to reduce pollution much more cost effectively, and we should do that.
Okay, thank you, members. With that, we are adjourned.